evening and welcome to the Spirit Revolution. I am Kathleen McGowan.
And I'm Philip Coppens.
And we are very excited to bring you the second edition of our show. And we have a very, very special spiritual revolutionary on with us tonight. We're really excited tonight to bring you a special interview that we have done with author and researcher Andrew Collins. Philip and I were both really excited to bring Andy onto the show because when we first proposed this idea of creating a show where on a weekly basis we would interview people and discuss topics that were controversial, revolutionary, and we were going through the list of people who had really inspired us and who we felt had been truly revolutionary for us on our own journeys, we both seized on Andrew Collins pretty immediately. I mean, we both said, Andy Collins is definitely one of those people who is out there, who is breaking the mold, who's taking chances, and has certainly been inspiring us. For me, I discovered Andrew Collins' work back in 1991, when I was very, very new on this journey. And I have to credit him, because had I not began reading Andy in the early 90s, I don't know that I would have ended up on the path that I am on and have been on for quite such a long time, because his work encouraged me to be courageous about getting out there and exploring theories that were considered controversial and going against the odds. So I am certainly grateful to him for that and very excited about his work. Certainly, I think that a lot of Americans are not as familiar with Andrew Collins as I would certainly like them to be. So I'm excited about bringing his work to a larger and more global audience and hoping that it will open people's eyes to some of the extraordinary research that he has done.
Like you, Andy was a big inspiration for me. And even though I can't pinpoint the exact year when I came across his book, The Seven Swords, it was somewhere between 90 and 93. So very much the period when you found him. And what I found so appealing in The Seven Swords was this weird and wonderful mixture of a person who is astonished by what he finds and tries to find meaning and tries to find an answer and tries to give something to the world which is so phenomenal. And what The Seven Swords did more than any other book, I felt, what I was reading, was that you could see the author and his personal quest. So rather than just psychic questing and writing books, you were with Andy as he went along. And that is something, I think, a rare talent, and also which is very engaging, and why Andy, specifically in England, has something of a cult following.
One of the things that Andy did for me was turn me on to this concept that psychic questing was actually a real terminology and a real discipline of its own. I had been doing things like that for a long time and never really realized that other people were doing it as well. So it gave me a real framework for understanding what psychic questing was and how people were using it. And that's one of the things that we're going to cover in the interview, this whole concept of taking information that comes through psychic channels, visions, dreams, professional psychics, other kind of visionary or psychic experience, and then researching it, really digging into those, to the information and the locations and going after it and trying then to back up factually information that is given to you in a psychic way or in a non-cerebral or mental way, information that comes perhaps in a more spiritual format, and taking that and then applying modalities that are cerebral and that are academic and that do have a historical context, and then seeing how those things measure up or even out. And that is what I find extremely exciting about his work, is how he is able to combine both of those types of approaches in an extraordinary and completely fascinating and very effective way. And as a result, Andy's work is so broad. There are so many subjects he can speak about and to in such a thorough and extraordinary way. We really could interview him every day for the rest of the year and never run out of incredibly interesting things to talk about. As a result, what we have done with this interview is we're going to break it up into two pieces. We will air part one of the interview tonight, and then we will air the second part next week. There was just too much great information from him to try to cut it up, and we decided it's best to deliver all of it to you, so we're going to give it to you in two shows. So tonight we're really going to focus on Andrew's new book, which is called Beneath the Pyramids, and these are his new discoveries on the Giza Plateau, which are so exciting. Next week we're going to finish up with Egypt and then get into the subject of psychic questing in a little more depth.
And I think that's probably the moment in time when we have to bring Andy in. And he is a true spirit revolutionary. He has been at the forefront of alternative research for decades. He started out as a psychic questing person who actually wanted to find out via historical research whether all the information he was getting through non-ordinary means proved to be correct or not, and we will come back to that vital aspect. But as time progressed, he began to move into archaeological material. What stands out to me is still From the Ashes of Angels, which is probably a book which put Andy on the map forever. And more recently, he has been not digging so much, but definitely going underground in the Giza underground, and has been making some tremendous archaeological rediscoveries, which is the reason why we have Andy on now. Andy, welcome.
Hello there. It's good to speak to you. I believe this is the birth of the radio station, so I'm happy to talk away in whatever way you wish.
I just want to say that we're really, really thrilled to have you, and you are truly a spiritual revolutionary, which is what the show is about. You have broken so much ground in your career, and you were absolutely one of my very first major esoteric influences, because I think that you've been just incredibly daring and brave in the work that you have done. And I also think that it's your work always proves out to be true, and I think that that is something that really fascinates me, that sometimes looking at your history, you've had these extraordinary sort of theories and books, and at the time that they come out, they might be really controversial, but as you watch over time, time and time again, you're proven to be absolutely correct, and your work has just been a phenomenal influence for so many of us. And I am currently holding your new book, Beneath the Pyramids, in my hand, and it's absolutely riveting as I'm going through it.
Thank you.
And it's with Beneath the Pyramids that we start. It's been a landmark book because Beneath the Pyramid marks your exploration of the Giza underground. Can you enlighten our listeners, Andy, as to what you rediscovered?
Well, in 2008, myself, my wife Sue, and Egyptological researcher Nigel Skinner-Simpson entered a cave underworld on the plateau at Giza, which records suggest, going back 200 years, stretch for at least several hundred yards, and from the research that we've done, would tend to suggest that they actually go beneath the second pyramid, which is the legendary site of the tomb of Hermes, a tomb which was said to contain this fabled treasure known as the Emerald Tablet of Hermes, the fabled secret of Hermes. And this we were able to get into. The first people known to have done so in 200 years. And it's quite an amazing discovery. You know, the book details the exploration, how we were able to get there, exactly what happened when we got there, what we found. And hopefully we can talk about that as we go along. But, you know, the importance here is the fact that for many hundreds of years, people have believed that there was some kind of cave underworld at Giza, and that it represented the so-called Duat, which was the term used by the ancient Egyptians for the underworld, this cave realm through which the soul was seen to pass after death, before it reached an afterlife amongst the stars. And certainly there are representations of the Duat underworld in other parts of Egypt, which sometimes they stretch for, you know, maybe 100 metres or something like this. But the importance about this is that it's entirely natural. This is the first time that an entirely natural cave system has been found in association, you know, with a constructed rock-cut tomb, which is the entrance that we found leads into this cave system.
So that's actually a very important discovery as such, but I think another very important message is here that mythology once again proves to be pinpointing the way and leading the way to archaeological discoveries. The fact that it's the Duat also means that what actually has been found, what has been found in Egypt, and specifically the Giza Plateau, kind of like shows that all of this is much more than just a dead or a tomb for a dead pharaoh. So where does this take us? What kind of road are we going into with this discovery?
Well, firstly, let's look at Giza. I mean, we know it as a place where the most famous monuments in the world are situated, and that's the Great Pyramid, its two neighbours, you know, the second and third pyramid, and of course the Sphinx monument. Now, obviously hundreds if not thousands of books have been written about these, but the general consensus is that they were all constructed during what's known as the Old Kingdom period of ancient Egyptian history. So therefore around 4,500 years ago. However, even by this time, there would seem to have been a whole mythology based around the fact that that these monuments and similar ones were constructed upon some kind of existing sacredness, something that existed, something that pre-existed there. And as far as Giza is concerned, this was seen as a place of the dead, a place that was seen to lie beyond the Nile towards the west in the direction of the dead. Indeed, it would seem that one of the names for Giza was Amenti, which was the actual name of the land of the dead. So in other words, when you crossed the Nile from the east, which was seen as the land of the living, you entered into this otherworldly or nether world, which was connected with the passage of the soul into the afterlife. And this was reflected again in the fact that Giza's other name, or main name, was Rostau, which means something like the mouth of the passages, quite literally the entrance into a cave underworld. So it's very likely that the existence of the caves that we found inspired the actual creation of the pyramids and the Sphinx actually on the plateau itself. In other words, knowledge was already known of those caves when the pyramids were constructed there. And that's really, really important. That's absolutely crucial, because what it tells us is that the much later ideas of the Duat underworld that are found in the various books of the dead, the underworld texts, were probably influenced by traditions associated with Giza and its cave underworld. So in other words, we should be looking for clues as to what we will find down there from these underworld texts.
Andy, I was so struck when I first started looking at this material by exactly what you're saying, which is that throughout the world, we see that fantastic monuments, whether it's the Great Pyramid or Chart Cathedral, are built on sacred sites, and that there are layers upon layers upon layers of sanctity in that ground, usually thousands of years worth yeah. of sort of sacred information. So we're seeing that here, and this was completely new to me. I think it's a completely new idea for most people, this idea that the pyramid complex could be covering this extraordinary cave system that is potentially sacred ground for ancient peoples long before we ever dreamed. My question for you then is, are we saying that the pyramid complex could have been built to protect or encase this sacred ground in some way? Or is it just that it was built there as a result of the fact that this was holy land?
I think I would like to see the answer as both, that it does actually protect and also celebrate what exactly exists there. But on the other hand, I think it enhances the fact that the cave underworld exists. And Mark Lerner, the American Egyptologist who studied for many years on the plateau conducting various excavations there, he has actually suggested that the chambers within the pyramids, particularly that of the Great Pyramid, was not about ascent, as in that they rose up through the pyramid towards the stars. He suggested that you actually had to descend within the passages of the pyramids to go underground first. In other words, they were targeted to go down, not to go up. You know, everybody gets this idea that if you go in the Great Pyramid inside the King's Chamber, that, you know, the first thing you do is just ascend to heaven. But of course, that's not the case. You know, the soul in ancient Egyptian tradition was seen to have to go through the underworld first before it could be released upon the horizon to then rise up as the stars themselves rose up into the sky. So quite clearly, if that's the case with the pyramids, the passageways are to create this descent down into the cave system, clearly and presumably on a symbolic level. But of course, obviously, the soul was seen to be able to travel through walls and false doorways and the such like. So the idea of it then traveling through solid rock to enter into the cave system actually makes a hell of a lot of sense.
So going back to what you said about some of the ancient texts, I think that sort of leads us naturally into this question about Edgar Cayce and the Hall of Records idea. I mean, are we looking at something like that, that this could have been a place where the answers were, and that this is one of the things that you descend into this hall? You know, I know one of the ancient texts refers to it as the Halls of Amenti, into these halls where there are answers, where the records are?
Yes, I do. I mean, clearly, with Edgar Cayce, he was a psychic. No psychic is 100% accurate. I know that. I've worked with some incredible psychics over the years. And at best, they are maybe 90% accurate, although a lot of them, the information that they give as far as actual historical detail can be as little as 50%, 40%, or whatever. So in other words, everything that Edgar Cayce said isn't necessarily accurate. It's patterns that I look for in psychic material. And when you read through, you know, the readings of Edgar Cayce, there's some really interesting stuff. I mean, to start off with, you know, he did focus on the area of Giza and say that there were underground chambers here and that they would be found. You know, I mean, he never said that they were at Saqqara. He never said they were at Thebes. He never said they were at Abydos. He said they were at Giza. And this is important because, as I said earlier on, this is the first time that a natural cave system has been found in association with ancient Egyptian monuments, you know, and therefore would have some meaning. So in other words, he focused on this. The other thing, obviously, is that he suggested that what was down there was something called the Hall of Records. Now, he saw this in terms of a physical counterpart, or certainly some part of his head, I should say, saw this as a physical counterpart of a sort of astral Akashic records, something which during his readings, the sittings that he would take, he would find himself journeying to in some kind of trance hypnotic state. And he would enter almost a library-like environment and actually be given a book, sometimes by this librarian guardian figure, which would symbolically contain the details of the life of the sitter that was actually there and present during the actual reading. Now, some part of his mind saw what was down beneath Giza as this is what his Hall of Records actually were, because what he said was, contained within them you will find written evidence of what I am saying. In other words, that there would be texts actually discovered that would confirm his readings. And this is really, really interesting, because the idea that the tomb of Hermes contains the Emerald Tablet or Emerald Tablets is an intriguing one. And I know that certain Egyptologists, who certainly wouldn't come public and say this, but actually believe that the Emerald Tablet or Tablets probably relates to texts that are in a secret chamber beneath the Giza Plateau, which will contain with them the secrets of Egyptian creation. In other words, the earliest times, the time of the gods, the so-called Zet Tepe, the first time or first occasion. The details of this will be revealed within texts that are actually contained on walls that may actually be made of green stone, and that somehow the idea of the Emerald Tablets has been distorted across time so that they simply became, you know, small tablets when originally they were much larger, possibly walls, possibly large tables or something, you know, with inscriptions. And that it could well be that this is exactly what Edgar Cayce was talking about. And I do believe that somewhere within the cave underworld, we are looking at some secret chambers, possibly one, possibly more, that will give us the answers we need. And I do believe that somewhere within them, the Emerald Tablet of Hermes actually exists. So whatever that is, I think it exists. I mean, there are obviously other ideas as to what we might find down there. For instance, it has been suggested in the various texts, the Books of the Dead, the Underworld texts, that there is some kind of symbol of first creation within a secret chamber at Giza Rostow. And this would most probably take the form of some kind of crystal or stone that would be very similar to the Hindu concept of the lingam stone, which represents, you know, creation, cosmic creation. The lingam stones in Hindu tradition were generally always contained in cave-like environments beneath temples, at the deepest and the darkest part of temple complexes. And they were thought to radiate out energies which were considered to affect creation in the outside world. And the removal of ligands would bring about, you know, death and decay in the outside world. This was a theme that was ably portrayed in the Indiana Jones film of the Temple of Doom. You know, the idea that the removal of lingam stones from, you know, their sacred place, you know, would cause this sort of collapse of like the sort of the energy matrix locally. So it is possible that something like this either exists at Giza or did once, or certainly that the room in which it was contained may still exist down there. This is, you know, a belief that I have that you know, there may be some kind of crystal or stone down there representing first creation. And the reason why I believe this so strongly is because it has been mentioned to me by psychics over the years. And the descriptions of it have never really changed. And I can't understand why people would continually come out with the same idea unless there was some truth in it. But hopefully we'll get onto that when we get onto the psychic questing part of the interview.
However, before we go there, there's one kind of like follow-up question, Andy, which is the question, what is this Zeptepi the first time? Why is it so important? What is the importance of this stone apart from the fact that if it is removed, it might bring death and destruction? What kind of stone would be able to do this? What kind of first time are we talking about? And specifically, why kind of, you know, did the ancient Egyptians place so much emphasis on this aspect?
Well, Zet Tepe itself is translated, as we said, as either the first time or the first occasion. It's actually the time of the gods, although in some accounts it's actually the time before the gods. It's actually the point when everything really came together for the first time. It's the point when the first temple was constructed in Egypt, the first enclosure was built, you know, the first group of divine beings came together to do things. You know, it was like the very foundation point of everything that became ancient Egypt in much later ages. And it was believed that the world came into existence at this time, or obviously, you know, at the very beginning of it, and that the soul, at the point of death, would return to a state as it was at Zet Tepe the first time. In other words, basically pure, as it was. You know, it was almost like, you know, resetting the button. You become as you were at the point of creation, and not just at the point of creation as in a Big Bang state, but almost before manifestation, before physical world came into being. That, I think, was the idea of why Zeptepi was continually mentioned in underworld texts, in the books of the dead, because, you know, the idea was to try and go back to how it was at the beginning. Now, at a place called Edfu in southern Egypt, there is a temple there which on the walls are so-called foundation texts or building texts. Now, in the past, all temples in ancient Egypt had their building texts. However, the best preserved of them today are the ones that are left at the Temple of Edfu. And these have an incredible account of Zeptepi and what was going on at this time. And it talks about these divine beings under various odd names, like the sages, the falcons, the Shebtu, the Ogdad, or various other interesting names which have various connotations. And they talk about them creating the first sacred land, and upon this the first enclosure, and upon this the first building, and upon this the first temple, and that this temple became the role model for other temples. That's generally how these building texts go. But what's so interesting is that it says that right at the beginning, what came out of the primeval waters was an island that rose up, and it was on this that the first building structure was created. And it would seem that eventually this was isolated from the primeval waters by land. And so it became almost like an island within a lake that might possibly have been fed by the Nile itself. And it would seem that this island became the original concept of what's known as the island of creation. It was also known as the island of the egg being a primordial symbol of creation. And not only was a structure built on this, but beneath it was another structure known as the underworld of the soul, the Duat Imbar. And it was said that these divine beings would actually descend down into this structure and perform ceremonies that would affect creation in the outside world, and that there were certain power objects in here which they either used or just were present. They got some very odd names like the sound eye, the seed, the embryo, things like this, which I'd like to see are references to this crystal, this omphalos, which is the Greek term for like a sort of lingam or sacred objects representing creation, and that this is what was actually down there, and that these beings would actually go down there, they would perform ceremonies that they believe would affect creation in the outside world. This, I think, is the heart of what was down there. And remember, obviously, this was all happening in the first time, the Zeptepi, and we can pin this down to a time period of history, because it actually says that all what was happening here came to a sudden end in the first stage, at least, by the appearance in the heavens of something called the enemy snake that caused absolute catastrophe and devastation. There was suddenly darkness, the waters rose up, all of the divine inhabitants of the island and the lands around were destroyed. And what I've argued in Beneath the Pyramids is that this was actually a memory of a natural cataclysm that took place probably around 10,500 to 11,000 BC, which is now pretty well established as having occurred within our world and was probably instigated by the fragmentation of a comet. that caused absolute destruction around the world. It's believed to have caused up to 70% of the destruction of the indigenous peoples of North America, for instance, where it seems to have been, where the comet seems to have actually fragmented. And of course, this would have caused untold other problems around the world, both from an earth changes point of view, from migrations of people, displacement of animals, famines, diseases, and whatever. And this event is known to have affected Egypt. There is a thick black carbon layer that has been found for this particular date around the world, including Egypt. It's known as the Oscillo Horizon, which shows that there were vast amounts of carbon in the air, probably from smoke from volcanoes, and other things like forest fires, the rest of it, that were thrown up in the air and gradually filtered back down and landed on the ground during this time frame. And I'm certain that what is preserved within the Edfu building of texts is a memory of this catastrophe around 10,500 to 11,000 BC. I have absolutely no doubts about this at all. And the work of Richard Firestone and other scientists within the past 5 years, which has been published as in papers and also as a book, now seems to confirm that there was this great catastrophe, something that's been known, for hundreds of years. I mean, it was written about by Ignatius Donnelly back in the 1880s, for instance. He gathered together, folklore and legends and traditions from all around the world, suggesting that something like this had taken place. And it's something that I've written about before. And, others, obviously, Philip, yourself, you've written about this as well. So we know that something took place like that, and I believe it affected Egypt. This is when the Septepi time frame was. And, of course, this is what Edgar Cayce also tells us. He says that there were people living in Egypt around Giza around 10,500, 11,000 BC, and that this was people that were displaced from other parts of the globe because of a catastrophe at that time. He links it with Atlantis. I think that, to link it with Atlantis is not an unfair thing to do, even though the whole Atlantis story is a different kettle of fish, of course.
When you're talking about the gods of creation descending into or out of the underworld, when you're talking about a first time, when you're talking about a landscape which reflects the creation myth, I am going to the Mayan world, where we know that places like Chichen Itza were also a three-dimensional representation of the Mayan creation mythology.
Yeah.
And when we look at the 2012 mystery and try to identify the heart core of that phenomenon, because so much has been written about it that actually the core phenomena has somewhat been obscured, you come across an inscription, the Tortuguero inscription, which is one of two references and the only contemporary reference to the fact that something was indeed meant to happen on December 21st, 2012. And the Tortuguero inscription specifically mentions the nine gods of the underworld doing something, which archaeologists believe the world which the nine gods were supposedly doing is returning. So I find intriguing parallels between the Mayan world and what you have been identifying in ancient Egypt. And I'm just wondering, whether you have seen those parallels, because I know you've been working on Atlantis and the Mayan civilizations as well, and or B, whether you have any opinions or ideas about the 2012 phenomenon as such.
I think I can answer that probably together, in the sense that part of the 2012 phenomena is obviously a rebirth of the sun, or a death of an old sun and a rebirth of a new one. And the experts on 2012 say quite specifically that this is reborn symbolically, as viewed via the Mayans, along a part of the Milky Way known as the Dark Rift, the Cygnus Rift, or the Great Rift, and that this could be seen as almost like a birth canal, where you know the new sun travels for before it appears on the horizon at that exact moment. Well, that birth canal begins, as the name suggests, in the constellation of Cygnus, which is the Northern Cross, also the bird or the swan. And I have found that the alignments, the positioning of the pyramids at Giza seems to reflect the influence of this particular constellation. Indeed, probably more so than they do the Orion constellation. Now, this is something which I could go on all night about, but I won't. But what I will say is that the more I find out about the importance of Cygnus in Egypt, the more I realize that it's significant to what the pharaohs believe would actually occur as they pass through the underworld and go into the afterlife. Because for the ancient Egyptians, it would seem that the Milky Way was a personification of their sky goddess, Nuit, and that the area of her vulva, her navel, her womb, corresponded in the sky to the area of Cygnus. This was seen as the womb of Nuit, and it was believed, because Nuit was the mother of Re, the sun god, but also of Osiris. She was the mother of Osiris. And in death, the pharaoh would have to become as Osiris, you know, as I say, going back to the way he was at the point of creation, to achieve rebirth within the next world. And it would seem as if the ancient Egyptians believed that the sun was reborn at the time of the winter solstice from the very area of Cygnus, and they actually reflected the positioning of the pyramids, not just from the air, but from the perspective of the rising and the setting of the stars of Cygnus, to somehow reflect this as in an as above, so below axiom. So you've got sort of similar ideas here at Giza as you have at places like Chichen Itza, which, as you say, is a 3D representation of the heavens. In a way, Giza is also a 3D representation of the heavens, but from my point of view, with a focus on the area of the Milky Way around Cygnus. But what's so interesting is that there is a slight misalignment of the three pyramids against the positioning of the three main stars of Cygnus, which I call the wing stars. However, that alignment, which obviously is now nearly 5,000 years old, is gradually correcting itself. And the closer we get towards the modern day, that alignment, that misalignment corrects itself. Now, actually, it doesn't correspond exactly until the year 2600 AD, which I've discovered is the precise time of the actual coming of the Age of Aquarius, the point that the sun, at the time of the equinox, as marking, you know, the processional age, moves from Pisces, our current age, into Aquarius, does not occur properly until the year 2600. And I find this all very, very strange. And it's something which I've been debating for a while whether I can ever write about. But unfortunately, people are not that interested in the year 2600 at this time. They're interested in the year 2012, when it's believed, obviously, that things will take place. But all I can say is that the misalignment, although it's only very slight, the slight misalignment of Cygnus is gradually correcting itself at Giza. However, unfortunately, it doesn't come together properly until 2600, and unfortunately, all of us won't be around then. Although, you know, let's leave it for posterity and see if people pick up on it on the time, because I get the feeling that there's going to be a very big party in the year 2600.
For those who are new to your work, I also want to mention that you did write a really wonderful book on Cygnus, and your books and information on your work is available on your website, which is andrewcollins.com,
yeah.
Right? Andrewcollins.com?
Andrewcollins.com, and the book was The Cygnus Mystery.
The Cygnus Mystery. So there's a lot more great information in that and in your other books. I want to ask you, while we're on the subject of Egypt still, one of the controversy questions, which is the Egyptian government. How are they dealing or not dealing with this information as you are uncovering it?
Well, it's focused through one man, and that's Dr. Zahi Hawass, who is the Secretary General of Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities, the governing body over all archaeological exploration work in Egypt. And it's a very interesting story, basically. It's almost like a pantomime in many ways, which a lot of people have been following all of the different developments over the last 5 or 6 months. And it's very odd, because I actually had an email from Zahi Hawass just within the past few days. A very cordial email, which discusses the tomb through which there is access to the cave system. And within it, he alludes to the fact that the tomb does now date back to the Old Kingdom, something which he'd not been accepting before. He believed that it actually dated from a much later period in Egyptian history. And that's a great development, because if the tomb itself does date to the Old Kingdom period, then that definitely means that the caves were definitely accessible during the time when the pyramids were under construction, and that's quite crucial. But that's only the latest phase. He will not accept that the caves exist. He will accept that the tomb exists, which he claims was fully investigated in the past, although it definitely wasn't. He claims that there are catacombs there, but that there are many catacombs in Egypt, and that within these, the mummies of birds and animals were often placed during much later periods, as they were within this one. And that's true. But what he won't accept is that there's a natural cave system connected with this tomb that stretches almost certainly for several hundred yards. Why he won't accept it is obviously a matter of speculation. It might be suggested that it's just going to cause them too much problems at the moment if they do suggest that there is this massive cave system there. You know, the world media are following this story. And they know what's going on, and a lot have held off from doing anything major because Dr. Hawass and the Supreme Council of Antiquities refuse to accept that anything's going on. They all know that I have found something, because all the pictures are there online. Everybody can see them. I've shown the pictures to leading geologists who won't be named, by the way, who work in the field of Egyptology, who have said to me, yes, from what you have shown to me, this is a natural cave system. However, until Dr. Hawass accepts that that cave system is there, and as the mouthpiece of the Supreme Council, then if he says they don't exist, they don't exist. And, you know, it's a difficult situation. It's one I am trying to deal with very, very carefully, because if I say anything too bad, then I will scupper any chances I have myself of getting to the bottom of this mystery myself in Egypt in the future. Now, that in itself might be a fantasy, but, you know, I am in correspondence with you know, Zahi Hawass. And I would like to think that there is a mutually beneficial outcome for all at the end of this. And, you know, so obviously I have to tread very carefully with what I say. I mean, I'll be honest, totally honest, but obviously I don't want to, you know, to upset him too much, because then it definitely means that it's all over.
I absolutely understand why you have to be incredibly sensitive in this situation, but I just want to say to our listeners that as I am holding Beneath the Pyramids in my hand, the photographs in this book are stunning. And the photographs of the caves are extraordinary, and it's just, I'm having a little bit of a disconnect looking at these incredible pictures of this cave system and hearing that anyone is saying that this doesn't exist. I mean, the pictures are certainly extremely convincing.
Well, I mean, the problem that we've got here is that if Dr. Hawass says they don't exist, then if people accept that he is the official mouthpiece of Egyptology, then it could be construed that I've got it wrong. But you've got those pictures in front of you now. You look at those caves. Do they look natural or do they look manufactured?
They look absolutely natural. And I have been in a lot of cave systems throughout Europe as well, and also in the Middle East. So they're...
Well, then that's a really important. That's great, because, you know, people could just say, oh, well, you know, Andy Collins is, you know, is making more of this than what there is. But it's important that other people, you know, like yourselves, you know, say this, we are looking at an actual cave system.
I don't know about you, but I am still reeling from this concept that if Zahi Hawass says it's so, then it's so, regardless of the evidence. This whole concept that the cave system can't exist, if one man determines that it's not convenient for him to think so, is something that I find shocking. And yet it is something that we've seen over and over again through history. Really, a motivating force in my own work is to expose the lies of history. And this is why I always say that history is not what happened. History is what was written down by the people in charge. But to see this happening in the 21st century, to me, is what I find still shocking. I'm not shocked by the concept. I'm not shocked by the idea that people, specifically governments and representatives who have some kind of agenda, whatever that agenda may be, will change history and alter the facts to suit their own needs and agendas. That doesn't shock me. That will never shock me. It's always been, and so it will always be. But the fact that in the 21st century this still happens, and it happens so blatantly, is absolutely stunning to me.
And one of the problems is that Hawass is trying to become one of these big names who are notorious in their own time, but who will go down in history as being detrimental to the science which they were a part of. When you look at some of the controversies of the past, there are really some people who stand out. And when you look at their history of these controversial people, one of them is a person who was instrumental in the Mithras cult, Franz Cumont. And he really stamped down and said, Mithraism is this and nothing else. And everybody who's now studying Mithraism knows that after Franz Cumont, they had to throw everything out and start from scratch, because he had been so nefarious to trying to understand what this cult and this religion was, that really, it really was a big problem. When you look at other concepts like the Glozell mystery, there you will find proper archaeologists who continue to promote the fact that Glozell was a complete hoax. And we have been in countries like America and England exposed to this lie for decades, even though in France they have now given to Emile Fredin, the person who discovered this, national medals for making absolutely gigantic contributions to the field of archaeology. And those are just two examples. And Hawass is really playing with history. But the overall message is that where we come from, which is so important as to who we are and where we go to, and what we are as a species, is being destroyed, is being taken hostage, is being given over to ego maniacs. And in the field of Egyptology, unfortunately, that seems to be the person we're talking about?
Well, I'm going to quote you, actually. You have a wonderful new article coming in the U.S. It is out in the January-February edition of Nexus, an article about Andrew Collins' work and this cave system beneath the pyramids. And in it, you quote Hawass as saying, "I can say that there is no underground cave complex at this site." And yet, if you take a look at Andy's book and the fantastic pictures in it, how convincing and beautiful they are, if you take a look at the photographs on his website, we'll post a link to some video on YouTube that show the caves as well. You can check those out on thespiritrevolution.com. But I go back to this. Here is Hawass saying outright, "I can say that there is no underground cave complex at this site," when it is absolutely clear that there is.
And that's some of the problem, where we surrender, and specifically the media in this case surrenders to people like Hawass, have almost a direct line to newspaper columns, and they are quoted verbatim, and everything they say is taken as if God has spoken himself. And that is really something which is damaging to our understanding, and it's something whereby people like Nexus magazine, why they print articles like these, because they know that the proper media is not shown or not willing to show the alternative side. They just take whatever Hawass says, even though it is the biggest of lies imaginable.
Well, hail to Nexus magazine for having the kind of courage to print articles like this. I certainly see major correlations between Egyptology and biblical studies, certainly in that during my time as writing about Mary Magdalene, every article that was ever printed about my work on Mary Magdalene in the south of France always ended with a biblical scholar from the U.S. stating that everything I said was wrong because it didn't fit in with their specific academic perspective. And they are always given the last word, and they're always treated as the only authority. And as a result, real, true, exciting research is shut down. And as spirit revolutionaries, we are not going to allow that to happen, and we're always going to be a voice for the people who are truly out there trying to find the truth.
Philip, you've spent a lot of time working on Egyptology. Your book, The New Pyramid Age, is extremely controversial. Why do you think these new discoveries about pyramids, and specifically pyramids in Egypt, are constantly considered not only controversial but scary to established archaeology?
Well, I think part of the problem is that there are two issues at work here. One of them is the establishment archaeologists who hate intruders, who are not part of that little gang, and Andy is definitely one of those. But unfortunately, the history of great archaeological discoveries shows that the great archaeological discoveries are quite often made by outsiders, because quite frankly, that is what is required to think out of the box. You have to be a person who's outside of the box. But also, I think there is this drive from scientists, which is part of the scientific approach, that there should be a thesis which should stand out there, and that then others should attack it and try and disprove it. And that is very much a bullying tactic. It's very much also a male-driven tactic. It's not really science as such. And people like Andy and various other people on this subject, I think the entire world perhaps needs to move to an understanding that certain things, certain questions will not be given a definitive answer for a period of time, because some of these things are just very difficult to understand. The pyramids are big, and simply because there's a sarcophagus in there doesn't necessarily mean there were people buried there. For people to be buried in there, you need to find dead bodies. And the sad matter of the fact is that in all pyramids, not a single body has ever been found of a deceased pharaoh. And just brushing this aside and saying, oh, it means grave robbers have gone in there, simply does not stand. They have found intact tombs whereby the sarcophagus proved to be empty. And it's controversial evidence like this that scientists just do not want to really address. They really just go for the big theory and leave it at that.
I think overall people are afraid to rewrite history. I think that I think that the average human being finds some kind of real comfort in history and leaving history the way that it is. I, for one, am not content to leave history the way that it is and will spend the rest of my life personally searching for the truth in all of these different locations, different arenas, different mediums, in much the same way that Andrew Collins has and in much the same way that you have. I prefer to look at our human history as a beautiful collage or a mosaic where there are all these extraordinary pieces that we can put together from all these different sources and look at this beautiful piece of art, which is where we have come from. And I'm afraid that if we strictly look at the academic evidence, all we're going to have is this very black and white line drawing of our history as opposed to this extraordinary piece of beauty, which I think is what we truly come from. So until next week, thanks for joining us on The Spirit Revolution. Go out and create a little bit of revolution in your own lives, and we'll see you next Tuesday.